Thank you, Tom. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. All right. Well, it's of course, it's always a pleasure to come to Fields. It's a pleasure to speak. And today I have the unusual pleasure of talking about work, which is actually not entirely my own. Okay, this is work which was done by Marcos Escobar, who's right here, is my PhD student, just finished his PhD a few days ago, actually. Okay, did actually part of his thesis, and it's a very nice result. It's not mine, so I can say it's a very nice result. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Okay, it has to do with pricing default correlation products within structural frameworks. So it's about credit risk, okay, and the agenda of what we're going to be doing is as follows. Now, I will refer your memory. This is very well known, but I'll tell you about CDOs and through default swaps. And I'm going to, I mean, those who know me know that when I'm talking, I want to have my share of fun, okay? So there's going to be a fun component, fun for me, I'm not sure for you, okay? There's going to be a fun component to this, which is I'm going to talk about a money-back guarantee swap, okay? I know you've never heard of it before. In fact, we just thought of that a few days ago, okay? Just to make it fun, but it's actually related to other things that you may have heard or not. I'm not sure about that. Some of you may, which is CFOs. This is not a chief financial officer. This is a collateralized fund obligation, okay? Not sure if you know about them. They are very interesting instruments, and they haven't been very successful. They are hard to sell, and I thought this money-back guarantee swap may actually ease in selling those CFOs. So that'll be that'll be for me to enjoy. Okay, I'll tell you about that. It's a fun thing. Anyway, so I'll introduce those instruments for those who don't know about them. I'll remind you what the structural framework is. Again, you probably already know. I will talk about the a bit of probability theory, which is actually the heart of this. Okay. I will talk about two-dimensional issues where we can actually see things explicitly, okay, and extensions. Then we'll talk about the pricing of those derivatives, and then I'll end with some conclusions, okay? So that's the agenda for today. Of course, you are supposed to ask when you don't understand, or you are supposed to ask when you feel curious, okay? No need to wait until the end. Now, you know what this is, okay? Nth to default swap. It's a product you use to protect yourself of certain things. The buyer of the protection basically pays a rate on a certain notional, okay? So you think of it as an interest rate. And what you have here is you have n reference entities, okay, that may default. And what this nth to default swap does for you is it's going to pay some money, okay? Pay some money when the nth default occurs. Now, the reason why this is interesting is because you are able to take, say, a pool of defaultable securities and then strip the credit aspects of it into riskier and less risky, okay? So you may have a wider investor audience to sell these to, okay? No, it's a very well-known product. Now, CDOs are just as well-known, or perhaps sometimes even better known. What you do here is you have a portfolio of a number of securities, and from a portfolio of n instruments. So here's, you take a portfolio of say, loans, okay, or bonds, or something like that. Which may have different credit qualities. You pull them together, okay, and then what you do is you slice off the potential losses from that portfolio into tranches, okay? Tranche is the name. The first tranche is the one that's going to absorb the first, say, 5% of the losses, okay? The other tranches, if only 5% of the losses occur, the other tranches are very happy. They just keep getting an interest, okay, which is, of course, a premium interest over, say, LIBOR. The first tranche is very unhappy because they actually lose that. Okay. Now, of course, why would they do that? They would do it because if they end up not losing anything, if none of the securities defaults, then they get typically a huge spread over LIBOR. Okay. So it's of interest to the more aggressive investors. Okay. The riskier investors. Now, if a lot of defaults occur, God forbid, then what happens is, the owners of the tranches below end up incurring into losses. Okay. Of course, it's more infrequent, more unlikely that the lower tranches enter into losses, and because of that, they get a smaller spread over LIBOR or whatever the reference interest rate is. Okay. So it's a good way of taking some credit risk on a typically in a debt instrument, and then repackaging all the default risk in a way that you can give it to investors from the most aggressive to the least aggressive. Okay, you can imagine that the buyer of the bottom tranche, which is the one that will lose money last, is actually pretty secure. You need basically all of those instruments to default, right? So it's very secure. It's still, they pay a nice spread over LIBOR, so it continues to be appealing even to risk-averse investors, okay, and it's a way to give a lot of liquidity to the credit market, okay. So this so far so good, okay. This is very standard, and now it's my turn to have some fun, okay. So I want to tell you about a new type of option. Before I do that, I want to tell you or remind you where the CFO is, okay. Actually, who has seen a CFO before? I'm curious, in the audience. CFO? Seen a CFO? Okay. Okay. In fact, yeah, I knew that. Anybody else? No one else. Okay. Actually, let me tell you why, and here's how I would prefer you to think about CFOs. I want to give an example of a CFO. Very few CFOs have been done, okay? And actually, many of them actually didn't sell very well. But there's one that I want you to keep in mind. And of course, I had to bring up hedge funds. But those who know me know that I hardly ever do anything which is not related to a hedge fund somewhere. Okay, well, this is there's a bit of a hedge fund theory right here. And I want to tell you about a CFO that was done about a year ago. It was issued by a Dresdner Bank. And it uses, so it works as follows, okay? A bank, say Dresdner Bank, is going to do the following. It's going to issue securities, okay? It's going to issue some bonds, okay? You will see what kind of bonds they are, to bond investors, okay? The fact that it's a bond means that it's a defaultable bond, okay? The bond could default. You will see how. And what the investor is going to get is a bond, so he's going to get a certain return with a spread over LIBOR over a certain notional, okay? That's what a bond is going to be. It may have a coupon payment. Typically, it doesn't have coupon payment. It's just, in this case, the one I'm going to tell you about is just one big floating rate coupon. One fixed coupon paid at the end. Although it could have coupons throughout the period. So, you know, zero coupon or coupon bearing bond. Doesn't matter. That's what it sells. Okay, with a spread. And then it sells equity. Okay, an equity to an equity investor. Okay, and the way it works for simplicity is imagine that I am the equity investor. Okay, and I put a dollar into this equity investment offered by Dresdner. Then each of the bond investors say they put a dollar each. Okay, into these bonds bought by Dresdner. So Dresdner now has $4, my $1, and all of the $3 from each of the three bond investors. You see? So $4. What does Dresdner do with $4? It takes them and invests them in a fund pool. Okay? The particular case I'm talking about, and this is interesting, the fund pool is a pool of hedge funds. Okay? Actually, it's the pool of hedge funds that constitute the HFR index, the hedge fund research index. Some hedge funds. Okay? You know which they are? You ask Adrian. He'll tell you. Okay? A fund pool. Okay? And the way it works is as follows. The bond investors are going to get their return, okay? Interest plus spread. The equity investor is going to get everything that's left. In other words, if the fund pool does very well, has great return, then you pay the interest to the bond investors, and then you keep everything in excess of that. You see how good this is for the equity investor. Basically, I get, with $1, I get the return of my fund pool corresponding to $4. Okay? So the $4 double, I get 8. I pay 3 plus interest back, I get all 5 for me. You see? Of course, if the fund pool doesn't do very well, I'm the first to lose. I'm the equity investor, right? And if it does worse than my equity's worth, then the bond investors are rated. One starts to lose first, then the other one, and then, God forbid, the last one, okay? Dresner never loses, okay? The bond investors, these are defaultable bonds, as you can see, and default, this is interesting, default is linked to the performance of the fund pool. So this instrument is not strictly credit. That's why I like it. Okay? It has a credit component, but it has a very important market component. The market comes from this. Okay? Although I say equity here, never mind. This equity is not as interesting as these ones. Okay? You understand? So this is a CFO. It's very much like a CDO, except it has a very crucial market component, okay? Namely, the market behavior of this. If the market behavior of this is not good, those could default, okay? If this fund pool does well, those will not default, okay? And gets more interesting, because this fund pool, they not only are subject to market fluctuations, they are subject to default themselves also, okay? Understand? That's when it gets fun. When this thing has a market and a credit component all by itself. Because that means that the, say, the rating of those bonds and therefore the calculation of the spread becomes a very interesting exercise. And what's even more interesting is the value of that equity sold to the investor becomes even more interesting. Okay? All right, so this caught my interest about a year ago. So I said, well, let's think about that a little bit. And today, what I want to do is, there has been a lot of work on CDOs and CDSs, okay, and collateral debt obligations and credit default swaps or entity default swaps, as I explained. One of the nice things of the approach we're going to follow is that it allows me to price certain type of securities which have a credit as well as a market component, okay, and I have one here. I call it the money back guarantee swap, okay. Basically, what it does is this. This is expressed in abstract, okay? In abstract is, it's there. There's some reference entities. In this case, there will be the components of my fund pool, okay? And what it does is when those reference entities, say those hedge funds, okay, they default somehow, and it makes sense to talk about that, hedge fund default, then this is going to pay the buyer an amount which is equal, listen to this, is equal to the difference between the value of the hedge fund when it defaults and some reference number. Okay, basically, give me my money back. Okay, maybe the hedge fund defaults when it's worth 50% of the original value. Say, well, give me that 50% back. That's what I want. Okay, it's an interesting option in two ways. First, because it mixes credit and market, and we know those are hard things to deal with. And second, it actually eases some of the pain that equity investors face when entering into a CFO. Because the CFO, as an equity investor, you have a lot of upside, right? You have the bondholders' money working in your favor, okay? But if, for whatever the reason, there is a default in one of the components of the fund pool, this could be extremely traumatizing to the equity investor. Oftentimes, those fund pools cannot recover from blow-up events, okay, in the components of the fund pool. So this detracts a lot of the equity investors from entering into CFOs. Well, this would sort of ease the pain. It would be interesting to hypothesize as to who would be natural to issue this option, okay? It could be a sweetener offered perhaps by the bank, with a certain fee that takes out of the pool, because that's going to attract the equity investors to a product which to date has not been very successful. Okay? Anyway, so I thought, so that's, again, my share of fun. At some point a little later, we will see that actually the point of view we're going to adopt is going to actually take care of pricing those fairly exotic securities. All right, so a review of the structural framework, as is well known, it makes some basic assumptions. We're going to be dealing, remember, with a bunch of firms, and by the Merton model, we'll say that a certain firm defaults as soon as the asset value is less than a certain number. Okay? Just one thing. I did talk about hedge funds a little later before. This is interesting because this applies to hedge funds very, very well. One of the nice things about hedge funds is that they're very simple businesses. Their assets and liabilities are very well known, not like, say, an airline, for instance. Okay? It's very hard to value an airline's assets. A hedge fund is actually a lot easier, too. So it seems that this structured framework applies fairly well to something like a hedge fund or a simple business like that. All right? Well, I'm talking about simple from the point of view of the accounting. Okay? So this is the Merton model. The assets, we're going to assume, as Merton does, that they follow a log normal process with constant drift and volatility. Okay? Why not? And we will also assume that the interest rate is going to be constant. Okay? You want to remove these assumptions, then you talk to me and we have some fun. Okay? So for now, they're going to be assumptions for today. All right? Okay. Again, this is the Merton model. And what I want to do now is... okay. Now, I know this is going to be heavy to swallow, okay? So we'll go through it slowly, all right? And we may have to come back to this. When you have that, so think of, you know, a number of reference entities. Each of them may default at some point in time. So let's begin to define, things dealing with their default events, okay? The first would be the time of default of firm I. Of course, it's a random variable, okay? It's a random variable. Because of my structural framework, it's defined, the probability distribution of that default time is given exactly by what you see up there, okay? You look at the evolution of the firm's assets up to a certain point in time, and if at some point the minimum of that has dipped below my default point, say the value of my liabilities, then a default occurred, okay? In other words, the nice thing about this time is that its probability distribution function can be written in terms, look at this, of the minimum of a Brownian path, so to speak, okay? Now, this is beginning to, well, I'm not sure to you, but this is beginning to look good to me, okay? Because as you will see, the key mathematical aspect of this is that we will be able to explicitly handle the minimum of Brownian paths. It actually can be done. Okay, so this point of view is going to be fruitful. It's going to yield interesting results. So that's the first aspect, is the time of default of firm I. Okay. Now, that's T sub I. Okay, or tau sub I. I have a tau super J. Okay, note that in one of them the index is a sub index, the other it's a super index. You see that right below? It's very easy to confuse the two. I do it all the time, okay? So in one is the time, a random variable of the point of firm I. In the other one is the time when, if j is equal to, say, 3, is the time when the third default occurs, okay? Why am I looking at this? I'm looking at this because, say for a CDO or a CDS, it's maybe not the first default that matters to me. Maybe it's the fifth default. In which case, what I'm interested in is, well, when will be the time that the fifth security defaults on me? That's the one I care about, right? Well, that's what that is, okay? So one of them is the time in which firm number 3 is going to default, and the other is when the third default will occur, and you see they're not the same thing, right? No one is telling me that firm 3 will default the third time. Firm number 3 is just a name, just a number, okay? All right. Well, Probability, yes. Yes. Ooh. I want to give you my favorite answer. It's actually both. Okay? In the sense that if I use the physical measure for the for that probability, then what I get is the physical measure distribution for that time to default. And if I use the risk neutral measure, then I end up with a risk neutral measure. Sorry, I end up with a risk neutral time to default. Okay, so far I haven't decided which of the two I'm going to use. So at this point, both work. In the end, because I'm going to use the structural approach, would make sense to use to take the risk neutral measure for this. Yes? Okay, but at this point, and I say this because today I'm going to do the structural approach, and that's what actually the title was. It is going to be possible, I don't know how to do it yet, okay, but it's possible to turn this into a reduced form approach, in which case you would use the real world measure or the physical measure. Okay, and the advantage is that this approach so far is going to work for both of them, depending on which measure you use. So you end up with the risk neutral time to default or the real physical measure time to default. Okay? All right. The next object of desire is going to be the probability. It's a probability distribution that exactly J defaults occur at a certain time. Okay? Again, it makes sense. Think of the nth to default swap. An nth to default swap is going to pay something or cost something if the jth or nth security defaults, right? So it's going to be important for us to know when that time will be. Okay, that's going to be the basic building block for the entire theory. Okay, it's the event when J default occurs and the associated probability. Now, the thing about the associated probability, and what the only thing that's relevant for us, is that it can be expressed once again explicitly in terms of that minimum of Brownian paths. Okay, that's what that says there. It's a long formula, but you don't need to look at it. Just realize that what it says is it expresses that probability in terms of the minimum, in terms of the joint probability distribution of the minimum of Brownian paths. Are you following me? You have different paths, one for each firm. Okay, over time, now you don't look at the evolution of the firm's assets, you look at the minimum of that. Okay? Well, that will have a distribution. And so that I make absolutely sure you're with me, let me say that if you remove the minimum assumption, then we know where that probability distribution is. Okay? It's going to be a log normal distribution. But because we look at the minimum of the firm's asset values, then it will be a different probability distribution. Okay? Which we're about to find out, by the way. All right? So the important thing is that I'm going to express that probability of default, which is key for me, in terms of something that I can mathematize and think of the probability distribution of the minimum of Brownian paths. All right. That's the basic building block. Okay. After that, everything is sort of a downhill. I can get the probability of at least J defaults before a given time as a combination of my pi probability distributions. Okay. And I can get the probability density for my random time when the jth default occurs. Okay, it's going to be given by the if that's the probability distribution, then the density is going to be the derivative of that with respect to time. Okay, the density is the derivative of the distribution. And what is important is that everything that matters in the end is the joint distribution of my firm's asset values and the minimum over a period of time of the firm's asset values. Okay? That's what matters. Complicated formulas, but they all depend on one thing, which is the joint probability distribution of the asset values and their minimum. Okay, was this too much? No, it's too little. Yeah. Well, if this is too little, then sorry, this is about the most difficult slide today. So you came to the wrong talk. Okay, I'm going to leave it aside. I may have to come back to that. Okay. So then, once I've done this, this is the key mathematical result. Actually, this may look worse to some of you. It's actually easier than this one. Okay. At least there's no sub-indices, super-indices that look the same. All right. And the beauty of this is, in a nutshell, is that if what I do is I look at the probability distribution of that minimum of Brownian paths and the actual ending value of the paths themselves, that has a fairly simple Fokker-Planck equation that I can solve. Okay? It's given by... actually this, okay, and let me spend a bit of time explaining this. This is the key part, so I want to explain this. I just want to explain, why this is so. You have no interest in that, okay, you can read it. Let me just tell you what this means and what this is going to do for us, okay? By the way, and then I'm going to show you the case of n equals 2, when I can actually write down things explicitly, okay? And the case of n equals 2 was actually not done by us. It was done by other people. It's interesting. I'll tell you about that. All right. Now, so that's the probability distribution that I have is going to be given by a certain probability density and then my usual Lebesgue differentials. Okay? All right. Well, that density satisfies the following partial differential equation. It's an interesting partial differential equation. It's going to be, it's parabolic. This looks like a Laplacian term. Okay. This term, for today, don't look at it. Okay, it's not going to do much for you if you look at it today. Okay. Think of this as simply the good old heat equation with the Laplacian term, and that's it. Okay. This is a bit of a, you see, mu is one of the variables, right? So it's, but don't look at it. Today, don't look at it. Okay, just a heat equation, the good old heat equation, which lives in something like an quadrant or an octant, depending on how many dimensions you are. Okay? So it's not over the entire space. It's only on that. And I have a boundary value, which is that the density has to vanish when I reach that boundary of that quadrant, okay, or hyper quadrant. Understand what I'm saying? If this was the heat equation, if these numbers were all one, okay, they're not. If that thing was not there, then this is something which you can solve, okay? You can solve. It's basically the heat equation on a quadrant. So you can do that. Yes? How many people cannot do that? I'm curious. No? You cannot? Okay. Well, that's something that you can do, okay? You can say, well, how unfortunate, this is a bit more complicated. It's actually not that much more complicated. It's just a PDE, you know? Just a PDE. Now, PDEs can be bad, okay? PDEs can be bad. They may be very difficult to solve. And what I have to say here is that, see, this PDE lives in a dimension which is very high. Okay, is as high as the number of reference entities that may default. Okay, so you have a CDO over a portfolio of loans with a lot of counterparties, this PD actually can look pretty daunting. Okay, PDs are hard to solve beyond a small number of dimensions. The good thing is that they actually have an explicit solution or semi-explicit solution. Okay. They can be written, and I'll show you the case of n equals 2. Okay. By the way, if this didn't have an explicit solution, it would be nothing but a nice result. Okay. The fact it has an explicit solution means that it can actually be used for something. Okay. It'd be very hard to solve this PDE if n is equal to 100, for instance. Okay. But it actually has a solution which is explicit. It is written in terms of exponential functions, Bessel functions, Legendre functions, and solutions of one-dimensional ODEs, differential equations, okay? One-dimensional ODEs, that's very important. Again, if it was multidimensional, it would be nothing but a nice result, okay? Now, you may be wondering, why didn't I give you the formula? That's because I like you too much. Okay? This is all that you need. You want to know the formula? It's actually, we can get it to you, okay? And then you'll be sorry you asked. But it's the formula is here. Yes. Sorry? What is X? X is the number that, you see, X would is it represents the minimum of the Brownian motions, okay? Which is when they go underneath the number d is when default occurs. Which is the variable that allows me to tell when default will occur. Does it relate to anything? It's the value of the it comes from the value of the firm's assets. It's actually the logarithm of the value of the firm's assets, conveniently normalized. So it comes from that. Yes? Yeah, it's yes.
Do we assume that the assets on which you're assuming default, the probability of default is independent of each other?
No. No, there is. Actually, what I'm assuming is this. See, I'm assuming that the asset values are going to evolve as a Brownian motion, like the structural model, which it may be correlated among themselves. Okay? And the beauty of this is that I only need to know what the correlation is between their Brownian paths. The implied correlation of defaults is given to me by the PD. You see what I mean? Ahead of time, I don't know what the correlation of defaults are going to be. I don't know. Okay? I'm assuming that I can observe that the only thing that I know are the correlations of either firm asset values, or if I apply the calibration methodology of the Merton model, the correlation between the equity values. Yes.
Then the probability of the part of the end
will be very correlated.
First
will be close, yes.
Yes.
There will be hardly. There will be a small difference. Yes, you're right. Yes, and that will become. In a difficult way, because that what you're saying is something about the structure of that correlation matrix and how that affects the solution of the PD. You see? So the answer is I cannot. I don't have such an explicit formula that I can tell you. That as the correlations go to one, the default correlation will also go to one, but it's something which is true. Okay? It's hidden in the PD. Okay, the PD, it becomes useful for us because we can solve it and we can do calculations with it. Right? If you had an interest in studying just the qualitative properties of the PD, then that would be a natural thing to look at. Yes? Yes. 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 Well, the PD will tell me the exact dependence between the correlation of the Brownian paths and their default correlations. Okay? So from that point of view, and now I can go back to your question, from that point of view, if I use the risk-neutral approach, then there will be the risk-neutral correlations between the assets. The risk-neutral default correlations between the assets. Yes? That's what the correlation between the assets would be. No,
if they were uncorrelated, you'd have a diagonal matrix.
Right.
So the off diagonals are
the same. Yes. Is that what you're asking? I'm actually not sure about the question. terms of what, you know, what they look like. If the underlying entities are, now I'm going to play the credit matrix game. If they're in the same sector, then they will be high, close to one. You know, in different sectors, different countries, they may be close to zero, might even be negative. Yes. Yeah. The same idea is the correlation between the firm's asset values. Sorry, the covariances. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. No. Don't forget. The model that uses the firm's asset value modeled by this, but default occurs when the firm's asset value touches a certain boundary, and at that point,
and then the Brownian,
well, then the whole thing stops because then the answer to default swap, well, then you have to pay, and then that's the end of the instrument.
But
sorry. Yes, then?
And what, as it results, what happens to the ground motion from that point on? Do you think it just continues?
The Brownian motion of the firm's asset values? Yes. Yes, I assume it continues. Yes.
But it doesn't.
But it doesn't. Yes. Yes. Any other questions about this? All right. So I actually have here the expression, and this was not done by us. It was done by Repholz in '88. Okay, he did it in a different context, in the context of look-back options. This is what the solution to that PD looks like in the case of two dimensions. Okay. The good news is that numerically this can be calculated. It's efficient. It has the most complicated operation it deals with is an integral. Okay, the rest are all easy to program. Okay, so I guess if n equals 2, n equals 3 becomes more complicated. They all have the same structure. Okay, they some Sturm-Liouville functions. They some integral. The integral occurs because we have to integrate. When we're interested in probability of default, then we have to integrate over all possible ending values of the firm's assets. Okay, so there's always an integration that we have to do. This is actually a difficulty of the model. Okay, is that one integration that has to be done. For the rest, is it's all explicit, as explicit as this, as far as the computer is concerned. It uses Bessel function in higher dimensions, and actually even in two dimensions, and that's what it really looks like in practice. It's longer in more than two dimensions, and again, if you want to see it, I'll give it to you. Okay? Yes? So this is just to see what type of explicitness we are dealing with. And now that I've done this, let me just, I think I'm supposed to finish in 2 minutes, right? Tend to? Am I cutting into the cocktail or something like that? People will hate me for that. Yeah? Okay. Well, I was going to tell you, now it comes the time to do the applications, okay? The actual calculation, how you would price the nth to default swap. At some point I'll just say, well, and by the way, there are handouts of this. Did you all get one? So you can just look it up, okay? At some point my role becomes meaningless. So we are reaching that point, okay? All right, so the nth to default swap, we assume equal principles for simplicity, okay? We are going to assume a recovery rate. I think in the conclusions we will see that, it's probably a good time to mention it now, that this model also works when the recovery rates are a function of the firm's asset values, and that's useful, okay? Because oftentimes the recovery is not fixed. Is typically actually a function of the firm's asset value. So that this can be handled too. Basically, anything which is a function of either firm's asset values or the minimum of over of the Riparian paths, anything would work because that's what we have control over. Okay? Something that depends on something else may give us a hard time, but this can be handled. So you pay the loss given default, which is the opposite of the recovery rate, okay? And we assume only one payment at the beginning of the contract, just to simplify things. In that case, now if I use the risk neutral measure, okay, and now the question becomes important, then the expectation of that quantity, the payoff, the discount, and the I guess the principal equal to one is what will give me the price. Okay, so that would be the definition. That's how you would compute it, because all the other thing we need to do is this explicit, so is this, and this has a distribution function that was given by my function fj that, I remind you, was related to the probability distribution that is the solution of the PD. Okay? Yes. Good question. In general, I don't know if it's unique. I don't even know if it exists. I mean, risk neutral hasn't. It'll see if there are some assumptions. You know, where I get it from, whether I get it from. I mean, I'm making a lot of assumptions. Constant interest rates. So if it exists, then you take it. If it doesn't exist, then that'll be a different model, and you pick your own. Okay. That's a wonderful answer. Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, we're dealing with. I mean, there's something very touchy in this, which is the whole setup of the structural framework, right? And yeah, I mean, these are issues that are still out there, and I mean, they've been out there since 1974, and they still. So. Yes. In ideal conditions of, right. Yeah, so if there is one, you know, in the ideal world, you know, no volatility smiles, then there is one. If there is in the real world, there may be, you know, you may have to take a pick of what your risk neutral measure is, and then that would be that. So, you know, what do you do when you don't have a unique risk neutral measure? Is, or what you do if you actually don't have any risk neutral measure and market data is inconsistent, for instance, that's a very interesting problem. And I actually don't have an answer for that. Okay? Take your projection into the, you know, follow any of the methods to resolve the uniqueness of the risk neutral measure and then apply that to that one. Okay? All right. I really have 2 minutes left. All right. Sorry. Here's my remark. Okay. In the case that the recovery rate depends on the firm's asset values, this continues to work. Okay. All right. So that's pressing the F to default swap. Pressing default CDOs. Press this. You can do CDOs. Yeah. Believe me. Yes. And well, let me tell you about that new instrument, the money back guarantee swap. Okay, it can be priced. It's a bit longer. I do have to enter into some considerations between defaults and the actual ending value of the securities, because both will be relevant for me. Okay. And again, I apply the expectation using the risk neutral measure to get my risk neutral price. And I have to order the stock price. This is actually the value of whatever made up the fund pool, okay, whether stocks or some, or hedge funds, whatever it is. And well, so that's, it's an explicit formula, and 1 minute to departure, and basically just end with the conclusions of this, which is we obtain a closed form expression for the multivariate density of the minimum and the endpoints of a Brownian path. This was the the germ for all of this. Okay, this density can be used to price credit derivatives and to default swap CDO, even some fancier ones that use market components to in their definition. We can allow for some form of stochastic recovery rates, namely those who are a function of the firm's asset values or something like that, okay? Or non-deterministic principles, there are explicit formulas, and we can allow for the introduction of certain market variables. Exactly 10 to 6. I'm done now.